Anybody you know who's over 40, maybe even as young as 35, probably had a record collection when they were younger. And those albums that you kept on your shelf, if you were one of those people, were probably very important to you. But today, many people don't own physical copies of their favorite music or movies. The number one music retailer, iTunes, does not even sell CDs. And video sales are way down because of rentals. Hollywood studios are trying to adapt. They're developing streaming services and cyber storage that sell access to videos online. But NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports that some collectors refuse to adapt.
Kevin Bonds has this infectious enthusiasm for his DVD collection. We start the tour upstairs at his spacious, comfortable home in Clinton, Maryland.
I tend to put my, I call them tier one, or you know, most frequently watched videos up here.
Complete series of Pirates of the Caribbean, The Matrix, Star Wars, several jazz concert videos.
Chick flicks, or my wife's movies, I'm sorry. The Tyler Perry's, or you know, she's a big Goldie Hawn fan. She loves, what's the girl's name? Yeah, Julia Roberts. She loves Julia Roberts. You know, Pretty Woman.
But then we go to what he calls the good stuff.
Let's go down to the theater room area.
Kevin Bonds' basement is quite the entertainment center. There's a huge movie screen, big comfy chairs for a small audience, and row after row after row of DVDs. He figures close to 3,000 titles, including Planet of the Apes, the Legacy Collection.
A lot of stuff, you know, just memories from my childhood. I mean, I remember watching Planet of the Apes.
Kevin Bonds is the kind of consumer Hollywood used to depend on.
I think the studios would love to have more of him.
Russ Krupnik studies the entertainment industry for the NPD Group. He says studios and retailers make more money when people like Kevin buy DVDs rather than rent them. But DVD sales have dropped off dramatically in recent years.
Consumers are increasingly saying, do I really need to own this when I can have access to it as often as I want through a rental vehicle or through video on demand?
Krupnik says the studios are adapting. Primarily, they're developing online services, like cyber storage, where people would pay to have access to videos on servers in the so-called cloud. Disney's Keychest is one example. But will that be like owning the physical product? Not really. It might be hard to share with friends. Take the time Kevin Bonds loaned DVDs to his colleagues right before a massive snowstorm.
When I knew we were all going to be on lockdown, I came in and put a bunch of DVDs in a box and took them to my coworkers and let them pick out so they would have something to watch while they were snowed in.
That wouldn't have been the same if his collection were exclusively online. Russ Krupnik.
If you want that level of portability or flexibility, you still need, for the moment anyway, the physical format.
Krupnik doesn't think DVDs will ever go away entirely, but increasingly, personal video collections will be tethered to a server in the cloud, just not Kevin Bonds.
You know, digital downloads don't mean anything to me. You know, I believe in the collection. I believe in displaying it, you know, for all the world to see.
On good old-fashioned shelves, down here in his basement, not in some cloud. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
In an economically hard-pressed area of northeast Indiana, a double twist of fate has turned tragedy into success, and an empty Saturn dealership is now a niche car company for disabled drivers. Erica Celeste has this report from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Every year in the U.S., there are 10,000 new spinal cord injuries. Steve Kitchen never expected to be one of those statistics. But a decade ago, a friend offered him a ride in his new Cadillac.
Basically what happened is he was showing off a little bit on the way home and lost control of the car and we hit a tree and here I am injured.
Kitchen, who was in his 30s at the time, became a quadriplegic. His legs were paralyzed, but he still has some use of his arms. More than anything, he wanted to drive again. He got a minivan with hand controls for the gas and brake. The only problem was, he's a guy who closely links his identity to his vehicle.
A minivan is kind of the family truckster type of thing, and I didn't want to be the soccer mom type. I never really considered myself that.
So he looked around for options. Honda is working on an element for people with disabilities, and there's a company in Florida that converts basic pickups. but Kitchen really wanted a four-wheel drive. So the former ad exec designed his dream truck in the back of a barn. With the help of a few friends, Steve Kitchen modified a bright red GMC Sierra. First, they tore out the floor and reinforced it with steel. Then they designed a lift that works like an elevator. It extends so Kitchen can back his electric wheelchair in. Then it raises up and slides into the cab. Finally, they adapted the steering wheel with extra hand controls. He used the prototype to create a new company. But before he could even secure a factory, he was inundated with vehicle requests. Up until this point, Kitchen had funded most of the project out of his own pocket, and he was just about out of money. That's when Tom Kelly stepped in. Kelly owns 6 dealerships around the area. He'd recently lost his Saturn dealership, and the building was sitting empty. So he offered it for free.
My dad's favorite line was he never did anything on his own, that everything that ever happened to him that was significant was because someone else had lent him a helping hand. So I just sort of thought, I said, you know, my dad would be all over this. And I said, Steve, go start using the building, we'll figure it out.
You got earplugs on. Here, thank you.
The bright, clean space of the factory still resembles a Saturn dealership, but the 17 workers rotate from station to station, cutting, drilling, and welding. Kitchen expects his company will eventually employ 200 people. That's good news for the Fort Wayne area, a hard-hit manufacturing community. Kirk McKenzie, who was laid off from a nearby forklift factory, says his new job gives him more than a paycheck.
It makes you feel good at the end of the day. I've been in Chicago and Cracker Barrel parking lots laying under trucks, you know, that people are bringing, wanting us to do this.
Kitchen uses GMC and Chevy trucks that are built at a nearby plant. It costs about $25,000 to modify each one, about the same price as modifying a minivan. Dave Whiston with Morningstar Research is a fan of niche automotive markets, but he cautions that startups like this sometimes struggle to keep a strong customer base.
The trick is you've got to be able to keep your competitors at bay, and in manufacturing that's generally very hard to do because almost anyone can get a loan or raise funds somehow and open up a factory and buy some machinery and hire some workers.
But Steve Kitchen isn't worried. He has a patent pending on his modification, and he has plenty of other ideas. He says someday he'd like to design a wheelchair lift for the big trucks, semi-tractor trailers. For NPR News, I'm Erica Celeste in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
A new internet news site launched yesterday in Honolulu. This is a city that looks like it is about to become a one newspaper town because its two current papers, the Honolulu Star Bulletin and the Advertiser, are expected to merge. So this new internet effort seeks to charge for its news. It's called Civil Beat, and it's funded by a well-known internet entrepreneur. Hawaii Public Radio's Ben Marcus reports.
Half a dozen reporters, some clutching their morning coffee, have gathered around Civil Beat editor John Temple for their daily news meeting.
And this week, just to be clear, I mean, articles and beat updates and then Twitter are our focus, not topic pages, and we'll work on that. So I think we should jump into beat updates.
Topic pages? Twitter? And remember, this isn't your classic newspaper lingo. But then again, this is a newsroom starting in the year 2010. Temple is heading Honolulu Civil Beat not only because of his long track record in print journalism, most recently at the Rocky Mountain News, but also his extensive online work. After the meeting, he explains how this newsroom is different.
We're going to be sharing with the public what we're working on as we're working on it and the experience of working on it.
So the reporters will essentially keep blogs and send tweets as they pursue stories. They'll write regular news articles, but they'll also host online discussions of the beats they cover, like politics or education. And they'll maintain so-called topic pages, which will act as a constant living story, continually updated. So if you're interested in Honolulu's passenger rail project, there's a page for that. In the newsroom, the reporters type away on their MacBook Pros. News veteran Catherine Nichols recently came on board from the Honolulu Star Bulletin, a paper whose financial future is in jeopardy.
I've been writing professionally here for 16 years, and I've been at just about every publication, and I've done TV, too. So I have a pretty wide range of experience, and yes, this is different. But that's the thrilling part for us.
Civil Beat is the brainchild of billionaire eBay founder and Hawaii resident Pierre Omidyar. He says social networking is the backbone of his new venture.
The website itself doesn't have any super fantastic technology that's revolutionary, that's going to, you know, do any sort of crazy things that people haven't seen before. It's really about engaging with citizens, engaging with our friends and neighbors here in the community in a different way.
Omidyar wouldn't say how much of his fortune he's sunk into Civil Beat, but he's betting Hawaii residents will pay a whopping $20 a month for the right to read news and participate in the online conversations. Across the country, news websites are a dime a dozen, and most of those operations have yet to prove they can turn a profit. Rick Edmonds is a news business analyst at the Poynter Institute, a Florida-based journalism school. He says larger operations like Civil Beat have struggled.
On the other hand, having a committed patron with deep pockets and potentially involving some of your audience as members at least shows some potential.
If it's valuable, they'll pay. And if it's not valuable, they won't pay, and we'll learn from the fact that they're not paying.
Omidyar says that's one of the most important lessons he learned from eBay, which turned a profit well before other dot-com phenoms.
I mean, it's just a much simpler business model. All these other things where you bring in advertisers or you incur a lot of debt, or this, that's just far too complicated. I don't really understand that.
Omidyar believes that for journalism to be successful, the basic business model needs to be profitable. Despite spending countless hours of his own time writing code for the website, Omidyar says he won't let Civil Beat become a money pit. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.
Facebook is looking to expand. It hopes to extend its reach beyond its own hugely popular site and onto the rest of the web. The company is announcing a new set of features that link activities outside Facebook back to your profile. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Peter John Schuler reports.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg told a conference of app developers this latest iteration of Facebook is called Open Graph.
We think that what we have to show you today will be the most transformative thing we've ever done for the web.
Say you review a new restaurant on Yelp. Now with Open Graph, that review can also show up on your Facebook page. The same goes for movies or your favorite singer. And that means they'll be better able to target you with ads for products you might like.
If you write a review saying that something's positive, we can put that restaurant in your profile under a section of your favorite restaurants alongside all of the other restaurants that you've ever liked on any website anywhere.
They're doing so much to make more data about us available on the internet that, you know, there is absolutely no getting around the privacy concerns.
David Kirkpatrick is a senior editor with Fortune and author of The Facebook Effect. He worries many people may not understand the ramifications of giving away so much personal information. Modifications to Facebook have always met with some sort of backlash from users, but company executives are vigorously defending this new technology. They say users will have as much control over the information they make available on partner websites as they currently have on Facebook. For NPR News, I'm Peter John Schuler in San Francisco.
And now it's time for Backtalk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with us as usual. Hi, Lee.
Hey, Michelle. Well, another popular commentary from you this week. You talked about the recent New York Times CBS News survey. It described the 18% of Americans who consider themselves members or supporters of the Tea Party movement. And you shared your thoughts about what may be driving that group. And here's a clip from that.
My suspicion is that many Tea Partiers do see what's not working in this country, but rather than visualize what could be, are infuriated that others are not more grateful for what just is, even if what is not just or fair or even functional for many people.
And as I mentioned, your commentary was a hit, over 100 comments, and I caught up with Casey, who posted this response.
Tea Partiers see exactly what's not working in this country. Their representatives, aka political elites, has sold them out in favor of a radical agenda that the people despise. It's uniquely American to scream about taxation without representation, and that's all this movement is about. This is a peaceful protest movement. They're not breaking any laws. That's more than the left has ever seen fit to do.
Okay, Casey, thanks, but not everyone agrees. We were also able to track down Matt, who had this to say about the Tea Party.
It's not fear, it's not racism, it's old-fashioned ignorance. Seriously, if they actually understood what the Boston Tea Party was all about, they would have conjured up some other moniker. I suggest we hate paying taxes whatsoever.
Thanks, Matt. Lee, in this week's parenting conversation, we talked about the new book Mixed. The book of photographs shows multiracial children celebrating their heritage. After that conversation aired, listeners logged onto our website to tell us more about their experiences living in multiracial families. We caught up with Kristen, who says her mother is from Taiwan and her father is a white American, and she had this to say.
It can be a wonderful thing to grow up mixed race, but any question of identity is difficult, so it can sometimes be a hard thing, too. Growing up, I experienced a lot of feelings of not fitting in or of not being Chinese enough or American enough. I turned out fine, but that doesn't mean that I don't still struggle with being mixed race sometimes. Hopefully, by bringing these issues to light, we can help future generations deal with their identities with greater ease, grace, and confidence.
Thanks, Kristen.
Michelle, we reported on the passing of Dorothy Height. Now, the 98-year-old civil rights leader died Tuesday. She served 40 years as the head of the National Council for Negro Women. And on the day of her passing, you, along with Tell Me More producers Tashima Walker and Jennifer Longmire-Wright, posted a thoughtful essay to our blog. And it's still there, so folks can still check it out. Well, that entry prompted this reflection from someone who blogs under the name Dr. Tramp, who writes, quote, "One thing that greatly impressed me, which I'll always remember about the leaders of the civil rights organizations of the 50s and 60s was the quiet and sometimes not so quiet dignity that they portrayed and expressed in everything they did. Goodbye, dear lady," he says. "You're already missed."
He is right. She is already missed. Anything else, Lee?
Just one housekeeping note, Michelle. Last week, we failed to mention that one of the guys in the barbershop, David Hoffman, he's a contributing editor at Foreign Policy magazine and The Washington Post. He is a 2010 recipient of the Pulitzer Prize. And so belated cheers to you, David.
Cheers to you, David. Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. Over the last few years, Hitler has become the subject of a number of video parodies on YouTube. They all use the same grim scene from a German drama about Hitler's last days and turn it into satire. The parodies were incredibly popular until suddenly they started to disappear. NPR's Laura Seidel has the story.
The scene is Hitler's bunker in Berlin in the last days of the war. A tired, nervous-looking officer reports what is clearly going to be bad news to the Führer.
Mein Führer, Steiner.
If you understand the German, you know Hitler's getting bleak news about the German defenses. But if you don't, and most Americans probably don't, you read the subtitles. That's where the fun happens. People add their own subtitles. In one recent version, Hitler gets told that the new iPad can't multitask. Hitler rants about its lack of flash, lousy AT&T service, a name that suggests a feminine hygiene product. Using this scene from an Academy Award-nominated German film called Downfall, the subtitles have had Hitler, played by Bruno Ganz, ranting about everything from Kanye West's behavior on the MTV Awards to Patti LuPone winning a Tony. Millions of people have seen at least one version. Then a couple of days ago, the video started to disappear. Constantine Films, which owns the rights to Downfall, decided to use YouTube's content ID system. It works like a fingerprint system. A content owner puts their film or song into content ID, and YouTube can find every video that uses any part of a film, like, say, Downfall, says YouTube's Aaron Zamost.
And we're scanning every user upload against a reference database of over 3 million files.
The content ID system was a response by the Google-owned YouTube to complaints by big media companies that people were stealing their content when they put it up on YouTube. Zamost says the system also lets content owners keep up their clips and put ads next to them so they can make money.
We tried to build a tool that allows rights holders to manage the use of their content by users, but that also gives them, say, an option to make money from it.
That may be great for content owners, but it may not be in line with copyright law. Corinne McSherry, an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, explains that there's something called fair use. It lets people use a film clip or a paragraph from an article or a piece of music if they are creating commentary or satire.
And all the ones that I've seen are very strong fair use cases, and so they're non-infringing and they shouldn't be taken down. But via this filter system, they're taken down virtually automatically.
Fortunately, this is not Berlin in 1944, and Hitler parodies are appearing on other sites, including one that makes fun of Constantin Films for acting a little authoritarian. And the people who made parodies and put them on YouTube can appeal to YouTube for restoration on that site. Laura Seidel, NPR News.